Caribou Community Radio is hiring a development director. This 32-hour-a-week position develops and implements the yearly fundraising plan, develops promotional and press materials, and supports the anti-oppression work of Caribou. Send a cover letter and resume to Delphine Crescenzo at del@caribou.org or send to Caribou Development Hire, 20 Southeast 8th, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Please answer in the cover letter the question, why is Caribou important? Deadline to apply is Sunday, November 25th at midnight. More information on the development director position is available at caribou.fm/developmenthire2018.
Caribou Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor live performances by Tony Furtado on Friday and Saturday, November 23rd and 24th at 8 p.m. at Mississippi Studios in Portland. Tony Furtado is a Portland songwriter in the Americana bluegrass realm. This is his 8th annual Thanksgiving Bash at Mississippi Studios. On November 23rd, he's playing a seated acoustic show with guest collaborator Scott Law, with Jack Straw opening. On November 24th, he'll be playing an electric set with guest collaborator Stephanie Schneiderman. Richie S. Young opens the show. Again, that's live performances by Tony Furtado on Friday and Saturday, November 23rd and 24th at 8 p.m. at Mississippi Studios, 3939 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And this is KBOO Portland. It's 9:01 a.m. and time for One Land, Many Voices, followed by Valley Views. We'll round out that hour with Flashpoints, and we'll finish the morning with Pacific Underground, and all of which only happens with the support of the community. That's you, my friends. So, if you've not yet become a member of the KBOO Foundation, you can correct that oversight at kboo.fm. Click on the little rectangle that bears the word donate. Here we go.
You are listening to One Land, Many Voices. Today's show will be two parts. In the first half, host Leila Canaan speaks with Portland activist Heidi Lee, who attended the recent National Conference of Students for Justice in Palestine. The conference was held at UCLA in Los Angeles and was met with protests and hecklers who harassed attendees and tried to shut the conference down. In the second half of the program, we will hear a talk by Dr. Yasser Abu Jamia, the head of Gaza Community Mental Health Program. He spoke recently in Portland, Oregon as part of a tour to bring attention to the mental health crisis in Gaza due to the ongoing Israeli siege.
With us is Heidi Lee. She's an alumni of the Students for Justice in Palestine group, also known as SJP. So Heidi, if you could just introduce yourself, give us a little bit of background and what the group SJP represents.
Okay, so I have been an organizer in the Palestine Solidarity Movement for about 8 years. As well as BDS, which is the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanction Movement, connected to SJP, Students for Justice in Palestine. The SJP is a student network on campuses organizing around educating people on Palestine and bringing different organizers together to develop education and just to kind of educate folks on campus about the issue. And they have a conference every year that's been going on. I think this past weekend was the 10th conference that they've held. So that's how I've been connected to it. Perfect. And even after I graduated, I've still been doing work around that issue on Palestine. So, mm-hmm.
And SJP is in support of the BDS movement, the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions. What is BDS and how... How has the BDS movement in general been silenced in the U.S.?
So the tactics that happened, which I guess we'll get into later, at UCLA toward the SJP conference are the same tactics that have been wielded against the BDS movement. So the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanction Movement was founded in 2005 by Palestinian civil society groups within the West Bank and Gaza. Collectively, civil society, not part of any of the formal political institutions like the Palestinian Authority and some of the other ones, which advocate for equal rights for all Palestinians, the right of return. And so through that advocacy, there's been a lot of repression because of the charge and accusation that standing in solidarity with Palestinians who just want equal rights and equality for all means that that it's an anti-Semitic movement.
Mm-hmm.
However, we also, the BDS movement works very closely with Jewish Voice for Peace, which is JVP, which is a national organization of anti-Zionist Jewish organizers who educate around the issue about the distinctions between Zionism and Judaism. And we are talking about the political entity of Zionism and not ever talking about the religion, which we fully respect. So because there's a lot of misunderstanding, a lot of propaganda, a lot of disinformation out there about Palestine in general, it's very easy for them to paint BDS with a broad brush and to say that, you know, that what we stand for is against anything that has to do with Judaism rather than what we're talking about is the political state of Israel, which represses Palestinians through the occupation and the apartheid laws and the rules that exist. So hopefully that's helpful.
Yeah, and it's also so interesting because Super at U of O, you know, we also worked with Decolonizing Judaism, which was a group on campus, and we worked really closely with them when we were trying to pass the BDS resolution. And many of the Zionists on campus that opposed the bill said that we were silencing Jewish voices. But it was interesting because they were completely disregarding the Jewish people that we were working with. So
yeah.
it's a completely ironic and hypocritical situation. But anyway, so getting back to UCLA, what's going on there now? Yeah, so you said it's the 10th annual SJP conference at UCLA.
Mm-hmm.
So specifically, what sort of pushback have you all received from the administration and other opposing groups on campus?
So I can speak to it not as in-depth as somebody who's been, you know, a student organizing for SJP on the campus. But having been there for the whole weekend, I got a pretty good handle of what was occurring. So, and I'll just go back to what you shared about what you dealt with in Super. We dealt with the same thing when we were trying to get the BDS resolution passed through the Student Senate, which we did successfully. So I can totally relate to, we heard the same tactic that you talked about. So fast forward to SJP at UCLA. UCLA has a heavy presence of Zionist student groups on campus and one main Palestinian organizing group, which is Students for Justice in Palestine, SJP. So they're always dealing with backlash of trying to organize around the politics of anti-occupation, anti-imperialism, standing in solidarity with Palestinians on an anti-Zionist platform.
Mm-hmm.
So with that success comes a lot of backlash from the Zionist student groups. And so what they did was, in partnership with some Zionist community groups in Los Angeles, collectively they went to the LA City Council and they tried to bring charges of that SJP is anti-Semitic, it's racist against Jewish people, and that they should shut down the conference based upon that platform. However, UCLA, SJP at UCLA was able to successfully argue that, no, this is what we're about, and they were the Zionists were not successful in shutting down the conference. However, throughout the weekend, and this conference ran this past weekend from Friday through Sunday afternoon, there were tactics by the administration to get at SJP in a different way, meaning we went about a minute over on audio on Saturday night and they tried to charge them $500. They tried to charge them for distributing water bottles to everybody, so giving water to conference participants. And we had to resort to security presence, which a lot of Palestinians have a lot of, especially those coming from living under occupation, still very kind of triggered by, but the Zionist repression was already happening as of Friday. So we had to actually redirect where we were entering. There was a huge amount of security by student organizers as well as campus organizers. National Lawyers Guild came to witness what was going on. So we're able to subvert that. But then on Sunday afternoon, they showed up in full force outside the building, Dodd Hall to be specific, where we were holding sessions and talks. For instance, I was in a talk about refugees in Lebanon. Other people were talking about just the different situation Palestinians living under occupation. And so Palestinian organizers, while trying to talk about that struggle, had to hear chanting and shouting that they wanted them to go away. It was extremely intense. And I was, you know, we weren't quite sure what was going to happen, but we decided, everybody collectively decided that we would stay through the sessions, and then we would move as a group over to the larger ballroom where we're going to finish up the conference.
Mm-hmm.
Along that route, it was about 400 to 500 of us on the side of equal rights and justice for Palestinians, and on a, you know, anti-racist, anti-Zionist platform, marching together collectively with security, while about 100 Zionists shouted just really vile, terrible things at specifically Palestinians, and saying really inflammatory things. And so a lot of us who are not Palestinian were kind of shielding people. They were also trying to take pictures so they could create more canary mission profiles. And I was like, hey, I've already got one. Take pictures away. I used my keffiyeh to shield Palestinians so that they could get through. Super intense. And we made it through to the ballroom. That was about a 15-minute process. And it was, like I said, so that's what we're dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we got to the ballroom. We had been organizing, having lunch, and then a couple of Zionist infiltrators got through into a maintenance area and got up on stage and held up some stuff, and we had to do de-escalation tactics to get them out of the ballroom. And then we eventually had to, we decided collectively around 2 to shut down the conference early for everyone's safety. Those of us moved in groups, we went to go get lifts to get back to the airport, and there were a bunch of Zionists who were trying to surround us and take pictures and saying really nasty things. Again, many of us who were non-Palestinian were kind of just trying to protect those students.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sharing keffiyehs to shield people's faces. And, you know, I was kind of like, hey, go ahead. Bring it on. I will, you know, so I kind of was like shielding people. Many of us were doing that. That was what the weekend consisted of.
Wow.
However, the victory is that the conference went on. There were the most participants we've ever had. And people left there with an emboldened feeling of we're going to continue to do this work. And despite what Palestinians in the occupied territories deal with, and despite what we deal with here, we know we're on the right side of history. This is the right thing. We believe in equal justice and rights for all Palestinians and the right of return for the refugees and the end of the apartheid state and the occupation. So that is, like, I know that's a lot, but that kind of gives you an idea of what basically took place. But that is a snapshot of what's happening around the globe for what people do when you deal with Palestine and what you're doing this work as an organizer. So
to me, it's a huge victory that you got 400 to 500 people to show up. I mean, like,
mm-hmm.
again, I'm comparing this to my small experience at U of O or at University of Oregon, but like we had maybe 20 people supporting us and the rest was a room full of pro-Zionist people. And I mean, it was like 200
yeah.
people, and so we were up against this huge wall of opposition, and so that alone, like the support that you could garner, is that's really inspirational to me. But I read something about the UCLA administration not allowing people to fly kites, Palestinian kites, or so just can you briefly go into that, because Israel just recently passed, or at least they were trying to pass a law to make Palestinian flag flying illegal in Israel, and so I just saw like a, you know, a small parallel between the two.
Yeah, so what that gets at to, which you you're probably already familiar with, I'm sure you'll cover the Great March of Return.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's been releasing of balloons and kite flying as a symbol of, you know, we want freedom, people doing it in solidarity, and so there's that direct link with what's happening at the Great March of Return in Gaza, and then other actions, Friday protests and stuff in the West Bank, directly linked to UCLA. SDP at UCLA, in solidarity with that, decided to use the logo of the Black Bear, which is something that's tied to a UCLA mascot.
Mm.
And so the symbol on the shirts and kind of the theme, you know, everyone kind of has a theme and a T-shirt for each year of the conference, was a Black Bear sitting down with a keffiyeh, which is the traditional solidarity symbol, a very historical black and white scarf, which many people have seen. And then the bear is kind of holding on to some kites that's flying and kind of flying around. And so there's that direct link of solidarity with what's happening on campus to what's happening at the Great March of Return. So that cultural connection as well as that resistance against the occupation. And so then UCLA tried to shut down the use of that mascot because they said that's specifically for UCLA, and SJP organizers were like, well, we're students at UCLA and we feel like we should be able to use that symbol. We're a student group, we're a recognized student group on this campus, so we feel like it's all right for us to go ahead and use. So that was just another tactic that they tried to use against the organizers.
Right, as a way to silence, yeah.
Exactly, at every step. And I would be remiss if I didn't share one of the most amazing things that happened over the weekend, and I've got video of this, is that the spirit of Palestine, as you well know, I'm sure, is incredibly resilient and beautiful and gracious and joyful despite everything that's happened, right? It's very heavy work to do. But once the conference came to an end, somebody had turned on some traditional Arab music, and then Debka, which is the traditional Palestinian dance, kind of broke out. And so there was like a line of like 200 people.
Oh my God.
In the ballroom, kind of like, hey, we've been victorious. We dealt with all of this all the weekend, but this is what we do. We know. And just to be able to be a part of that is incredibly humbling and empowering at the same time. And just like, this is why I do it. It was just the culmination of just like, we will continue to struggle around this. We'll continue. And I believe Palestine will be free at some point. I think all of us that do this work know. I wish it would come sooner rather than later, but like, so, yeah.
I also admire your optimism and positivity because, I mean, there are times in when I'm reading the news or when I'm talking to my dad or I'm talking about this horrific situation that's going on, and I can't help but feel disheartened and discouraged and just like we're getting nowhere. Like we're taking one step forward and like 500 steps back. And just in your opinion, how, and I'm still trying to grapple with this, but how can groups like the Canary Mission and SJP Uncovered and like even the UCLA administration, how can they blatantly silence a peaceful human rights group like SJP? I mean, like SJP and BDS and Super, you know, and all of these different factions, they all, the forefront of their argument is human rights. It's like human rights is deserved by all. And it's peaceful. And I mean, BDS is the largest peaceful protest that we have for Palestinian human rights. And
yes,
it's just, it kind of baffles me how blatantly these groups can silence them and just reject them and call them anti-Semitic. And then once that word is used, it's like the group is done. You know, it's over. It's just so blatant. And I'm just wondering how it can be that way.
Well, first off, I would say that anyone listening to this would, if you're not familiar with the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanction movement, I would first encourage people to go to BDSmovement.net, which is the direct website. And just to say to BDS, it's fully centered on the Palestinian perspective and narrative. And so most of the people doing organizing work within that movement are Palestinians. This is coming directly from the people, either living under occupation or displaced in the Palestinian diaspora as refugees, coming from the history of the Nakba and all those other things. With that said, what a lot of folks I don't think understand is that the state of Israel is pouring millions of dollars into anti-BDS legislation. At last count, I believe there was 22 states with pending anti-BDS legislation that many, not only Democrats and Republicans and Democrats, are also on board with that. There is a lot of money being, so student groups that are Zionist student groups that are on board and against anti-BDS can receive excess money that other student groups don't get as registered student groups from the state of Israel, millions and millions of dollars. And this is well-founded research. This is not anything I have to make up or exaggerate. This is actually the fact. They're very proud of what they're doing. I believe the reason why they're able to get away with it is because the misinformation about Palestine and the lack of education on what it means to be a settler colonial nation, occupation, what is apartheid, all of those things, right? The history prior to 1948, where Israel basically, what I say, became a state by hook or crook in a very shady process. But it goes back to the founding of the settler colonial nation and the British Mandate in the early 1900s, where Palestine was literally handed over to the Brits through a letter, a written letter by Lord Balfour. Now, what I just shared with you, which I know you know that, but I'm sure a lot of the listening audience doesn't understand that history of how Israel became a state off of the backs and the oppression of Palestinians that were already living there peaceably with other Jews, Bedouin, you know, all kinds of cultures and people that were living there peaceably together. And so then when the British Mandate was put into force, that's when it became under occupation. And most people who have an opinion, I've been doing this work for, like I said, 8 years, and what I have seen in many different facets, whether it be on campus, whether it be at my job, whether it be just in conversation with people, family, friends who are not very knowledgeable, they don't know that it's like an actual occupation, and that it wasn't just, oh, they just kind of left their villages and they just kind of gave up and they've moved wherever. That's literally what people believe, and that Israel was founded because of the Holocaust, which you and I both know is not why it was founded.
Right.
You know, so I say all that for context, because if that is the case, if people don't know that history, then it is very, very easy to say what they're able to say and what they've been saying since 1948 about Palestine and Palestinians. And so they've been able to control the narrative. The other resource I really would love for people who are listening to this to watch is The Occupation of the American Mind, because
it's such a good, it's so good.
Yeah, it's hard to watch. It talks about the way that the propaganda of the news, just even the words, the way they describe Israelis versus Palestinians. And also, I would say there's an Al Jazeera documentary that was suppressed but has been released publicly to show the dirty tactics that the Zionist movement overall uses to try and get their information out there to continue this campaign of propaganda. They have a huge APAC, which is the American Israeli Public Affairs Committee, which was the first lobby in the United States right after World War II ended to get millions of dollars. So the corrupt lobby culture that we have in Washington directly goes back to APAC. So this stuff has been in place for a very long time. And so I think this conversation is extremely important, because I bet there'll be people listening for the first time that don't know about it and are like, wow, I had no idea. Most well-meaning people that I come in contact with and I tell them about Palestine, they are generally like, what? I had no idea. And then also, like, we, the Palestine Solidarity Movement, we have the facts and history on our side. I know the Zionist history. I can contend with the Zionists because I know what Theodore Herzl said. I know what Jabotinsky said. I've read a lot of their history to understand exactly what their priorities were to try and steal all the Palestinian land and to pretty much kick them out. And so when you know that, you understand exactly what these tactics are and how they're able to get away with it. But going back to what you said earlier, it is very disheartening. I mean, if I sound hopeful, it's because Palestinians still have hope, because I am pissed off half the time. I'm like, I don't understand. This is like, you know, there's so much misinformation. Nobody cares. It feels like a long fight. But because Palestinians living under occupation still have hope, they still go back to the Great Return March, whether they know they could be shot. Palestinian women living under occupation, being kicked out of their homes in a horrible section called Hebron, where they're just living there on the street, being kicked out of their homes, are still carrying on and taking care of their families and having hope that Palestine will be free. Like, that's why I continue to do what I do.
Yeah.
And this propaganda that they're trying to use against Palestine, I don't believe it's going to win. I say that still being very frustrated, but then, you know, that's... So, again, sorry, I'm being very long-winded, but I feel like there's so much information to cover.
No, it's great. People need the background to even understand what's going on in UCLA, you know? And also, I mean, just a side note, bit huge step, Airbnb just...
Yes.
Removed all of their, or like took out, what did they do? Can you explain what they did? They like cut ties with the occupied territories, right?
Yeah. So the other thing that folks should do their research on is the settlements, which are illegal under international law. So literally the state of Israel There in 1948, there was a certain section that was called Israel and Palestine. You have the West Bank and you have Gaza. However, in the West Bank, which is supposed to be contiguous Palestinian area at this point, are where the settlements are supplanted. So if you look at a map now, basically the West Bank looks like Swiss cheese, and settlements are illegal. They take over Palestinian land. So Airbnb has settlement houses or apartments that people can stay in. So like, I could literally go on Airbnb and rent an Airbnb in a settlement, which is literally built on the top of a Palestinian village. The settlements is this whole entire issue. And so then, because Airbnb decided to take that stance, if you watch now what the State of Israel did, it's now creating all this backlash against that company. And we'll see if Airbnb succumbs to the pressure. Mm. Because what that speaks to the larger question is that the pressure on corporations and individuals, when you go up against the Israeli state with all of the money and support they have from the United States and other countries like Canada and even Australia, it's almost insurmountable, and it's overwhelming, because it's sort of, as far as I'm concerned, Palestine is a litmus test. When people say they stand for social justice and all of these other causes, yet they cave on the issue of Palestine, it shows you very quickly exactly what those politics are. Right. So Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who has been this great radical fireball of this woman who's been elected, she was all for, you know, standing up for Palestine and possibly BDS. And then when she got elected, she had to kind of cave and kind of wimped out, quite honestly, on her stance on Palestine. So it'll be interesting to see if Airbnb decides to back down and relent and then continue to let settlement people get Airbnbs in settlements.
It's still great that they even took the first step. You know, I mean, like, we see artists all over the world that don't take up the invitation to perform in Israel, and like Lana Del Rey and, you know, whoever else. It's still cool to see that, even if it doesn't go through all the way. Like, Airbnb is this massive corporation, and the fact that they even took one step is...
I mean, the amount of success that the BDS movement has had, and it was, like I said, 2005, so we're going on, 13 years? Mm-hmm. The success that the BDS movement has had compared to what the... and it is modeled after the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Which I'd like to just let the audience know that the only government that was in solidarity with South Africa and apartheid and on the side of the apartheidists during that time was Israel. Even the United States took a stand against apartheid in South Africa. So you find that the whole relationship with that. Every victory, but the BDS movement has had so many victories comparatively. And you know, that struggle stands on its own, but we also gain a lot of some encouragement from what they were able to accomplish.
Right.
In South Africa, there's also a lot of solidarity from South African comrades to the BDS movement. There's a huge BDS movement in South Africa. In Ireland, like, there's a lot of places around the world where we don't see it in the U.S. media.
Mm-hmm.
I referenced that documentary earlier because I think if people get outside of the U.S. media tunnel, it's like a vacuum, then you can broaden the scope and see just how much solidarity there is for Palestine. Like, the protests and the marches last time there was a massacre in Gaza were just incredible. Hundreds of thousands of people coming out in the streets and saying, "We stand for Palestine. We stand for truth and justice."
Right.
You know, and like you said, many artists are starting to stand on the right side and saying, "I'm not going to perform in Israel." It's not about the individual artist; it's what that stands for when you go to the occupied territories.
Mm-hmm.
So there's also the other one I wanted to mention is PACB, which is there's also an academic boycott. It's the cultural and academic boycott of Israeli institutions. So it's not so much about, you know, kind of demonizing the individual. It's what that individual is connected to and stands for. And so folks, you know, again, a lot of misinformation, but again, folks should go to the BDSmovement.net to get the best information about what the movement has to say about itself and what it actually stands for. course.
Okay, well, did you have anything else you wanted to add, Heidi?
I want everyone to get on board with BDS movement. Folks can also look up Students for Justice in Palestine and see the amazing work that's being done. And I would say that anytime you can go to an event to learn about Palestine is great. I think learning from Palestinians and their struggle is amazingly inspiring. And the thing is that there is so much solidarity between the Black Lives Matter movement and the indigenous struggle and the Palestinian struggle. And to be able to see that, especially not coming from those cultures, is amazingly inspiring and shows me that that is the right side of history to be on. And so I think if folks can look at that in totality and realize that it's the right thing to stand for Palestine, if you're fully for social justice and freedom and equality for everybody, then you will stand in solidarity with Palestine. And by extension, you know, that means no one is free until everyone is free. And I will end on this. Nelson Mandela said, you know, basically we're not free until Palestine is free, because he understood what that meant. And so we stand on the shoulders of amazing people who have lost their lives to this struggle, but we continue it. And hopefully lots of folks will learn from this conversation. I think that's pretty much it. Thanks for making the time. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no, thank you so much. Have a good day.
You've been listening to an interview by KBOO's Layla Kanaan with Portland activist Heidi Lee, who attended a recent National Conference of Students for Justice in Palestine at UCLA. You are listening to One Land, Many Voices. The full audio from this program will be available on KBOO website later today. Go to kboo.fm/One Land, Many Voices. Up next, we will hear a talk given in Portland on November 16, 2018 by Dr. Yasser Abu Jamia, the head of the Gaza Community Mental Health Program.
I am just beyond honored and just so happy that tonight we get to welcome Dr. Yasser Abu Jamia. This is the second time that Yasser has come to Portland. And the first time he came, I remember him arriving with no suitcase, with no change of clothes, because he was given by the Israelis, after applying for a long time for an exit visa, he was given 40 minutes to get to the crossing, something like that. No time to, he was at home, when he got the call that he could go through. No time to go home and get his things. But that was when the Israelis decided it was okay for him to go through. And just to finish the introduction, I'll say I was with the same delegations that Clyde was on. I went in 2011 to Gaza, 2012 and 2014, and it was there that I had the honor to meet Dr. Yasser with his, I think all of our heroes, our mentors in the garden of Dr. Iyad Siraj, and who a legacy in Gaza community mental health and in peacemaking. And the first time I went, I took two huge duffel bags full of dollhouses and toys and puzzles and coloring books. You know, everybody else was carrying surgical supplies and medicine, and here I was carrying toys. And it was like, what? And the first day we were there, we went to Gaza community mental health and we set up play therapy rooms. And I started to hear about what the children were living with in Gaza. This was my first trip. The trauma, the behavioral, the educational, the developmental issues, the way that this siege, the occupation, is affecting their physical health through malnutrition and waterborne diseases, and their mental health. And it was at that trip I started to see the real importance, the heart importance of mental health in Gaza, because nobody in Gaza is unaffected. The counselors will tell you they go home to the same trauma because their families are living in it. So it's with that, I think, seriousness and that intensity and that urgency that we welcome Dr. Yasser. And so the bio for him is incredible. I'm gonna read a little. Yasser Abu Jamia is a psychiatrist, and he's been with the Gaza Community Mental Health Program in various roles for many years. Clinical work, research work, supervisory roles. Since 2014, he's been the director. and has been overseeing this amazing, amazing community mental health organization. As I mentioned, Dr. Yasser is a psychiatrist. He was trained at the University of Birmingham in the UK, the Free University in Berlin, Germany, Islamic University in Gaza, and the Kaunas University of Medicine in Lithuania. And he has child and adolescent psychiatry credentials from Israel. With no further ado, Dr. Yasser Abu-Jamai.
Thank you very much, Maxine, for the very warm welcoming. And it's really interesting when I was thinking, where should I land, you know, first time that, not first time, but I mean, where I would land in the States, given when I'm going to get the permit to leave Gaza, whether I'm going to start from San Diego as planned or maybe from a later or another step, you know. But what was interesting is that with each step, there was a friend who was waiting, a friend whom I met in Gaza or whom I met in the States. So it was okay, it was with Ned and Maxine. And speaking about coming to Portland, coming to Ned's and Maxine's, and also remembered Dr. Clyde Farris, who was just in Gaza a few weeks ago. So I'm really happy with the warm welcoming and with the friends that Yasser has, that Gaza has, that Palestinian has in the States and in any other places in the world. So thank you very much for this warm welcoming, and I'm really happy to see you all here. And perhaps I'll begin with a little story before just going into the presentation. And I'm going to continue to say on what Maxine was saying. You know, I just landed today, early afternoon, I think it was about 2 p.m., something like that, after I think, I don't know how many hours of flying. And then she said, wow, you look sporty today. I look sporty today. And then I started to think, sporty. I was wearing like this, you know, so. And then I remembered that in 2015, when I arrived, I was wearing a nice uniform, you know, a suit. And then I started to just get or bring up some memories, you know. And again, I won't repeat what she was saying. You know, we were celebrating the International Mental Health Day back in 2015, which is, I think, the 10th of October each year. When about like noon, I received a phone call, okay, your permit is ready, you can now leave Gaza to Jordan, of course, through Erez. And that permit comes for one day. So for that specific day, if you don't leave, then you need to apply again. And applying again means the same process, the same waiting time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I was in Gaza, I live in Khan Yunis, which is about 10 miles in the south. But Erez is another 5 miles in the north. So going to the south and then going to the north and then along with, I would just simply lose the chance, you know, knowing that the cross point closed about 2 p.m. for people who leave Gaza. Well, I was wearing a nice suit. What else I need? And I was at work and my laptop was with me, my presentations were with me. Everything is fine, clothes can be bought, no problem. So I called my wife, I told her, okay, see you. She said, what? She said, they told me, okay, you know, I was waiting, she was waiting, everyone was waiting, but we thought, okay, that's it. They usually tell people in the evening that's the perfect time. You know, they call you about 6 p.m., they tell you tomorrow you can leave. But in my case, it didn't happen like that. And I told people who were supporting me, you know, just waiting, you know, over WhatsApp and phone calls. I just crossed Erez. Okay, we're buying you a ticket. Just let us know when you reach Jordan. Okay, I'm in Jordan. Okay, we got your ticket. Just run to the airport. So that's how it was. This time it was a little bit different, you know. Maybe not a little bit, maybe more than that. But, you know, there are some similarities. So I was already now for about 3 or 4 months working on this 3 weeks tour beginning from San Diego with the American Public Health Association annual meeting, and ending with a briefing at the Congress at the Capitol Hill on the 29th of November. So everything was, you know, five, six different groups of people working in different states, everyone doing his best or her best, you know, putting things together, and I was waiting for the permit. I got the US visa in time, the Jordanian transit visa in time, everything is fine, and then I was waiting for the permit. And I was three on Sunday, no permit, Monday, no permit. And we talked to some people at UNRWA, they said, we can't intervene, you are not an UNRWA staff, but you are going to speak at the Capitol Hill with some people from UNRWA, we will try to push things. And then Tuesday morning, they told me, actually not Tuesday, Monday, they said, we are going to try to take you tomorrow to just where is to give you the permit. We are pushing hard, but hopefully it will work out. Said, okay, hopefully it will work out. Now Monday, you know what happened on Monday? Or on Sunday, let's begin with Sunday, you know. Was it Sunday when a group of people infiltrated into Khan Yunis and killed seven Palestinians? I think it was on Sunday. And on Monday then, all things started again. So on that day, they told me, okay, you might leave tomorrow. And then I was thinking, I might leave tomorrow, and then we have, you know, we are on the edge of a huge escalation. I live in East Khan Yunis, that all conditions in Gaza Strip are not really that safe. At least the sounds of bombardment are really scary, terrifying children. And those things intensify during the night time, you know. That's why most of the children in Gaza, when they show symptoms of trauma, they come with two things. They come either with bedwetting, or they come with night terrors or nightmares, you know. These are the main two immediate presentations of trauma in Palestinian children. So anyway, I was really so much occupied, my mind was occupied. What to do, what to do? I mean, I can't let all those people who were working on these schedules disappointed. I should travel, but again, how could I leave my children and my wife, you know, when things are really hard? So Tuesday morning, she said, the lady from UNRWA, you can go. We managed not to give you a permit, but to put you in the shuttle. A shuttle which is a service one day per week, Tuesday. People go with the bus from Gaza to Erez, and from Erez they go with the bus to the Jordanian borders. Your IDs, your passports are with the security officer, and to ensure that you are just on transit, you know. That bus shouldn't stop at any place for any reason, not for lunch, not for anything. I thought that's fine. So I went in the morning at about 7 o'clock, 7:30. And the local authorities in Gaza said, it's very dangerous, the whole Erez checkpoint. We are not allowing anyone today to exit. Only those who are severely ill, only patients. Then we tried for a couple of hours, it didn't work. So at 9, I thought, okay, I should go back home. And then I thought I'd go to GCHP, the place where I work, I'll see how many people are there. The bombardment was already happening, you know. So I found five, six, seven people sitting there, and it was interesting. No one, of course, came, not a patient, not nothing. It was like wartime. So I told them, what about having breakfast? Let's have breakfast together. Oh, good idea. Okay, so we bought some hummus, some falafel, some food for all of you who doesn't know those things. You better try them, and the sooner the better. So, okay, we ate breakfast for 30 minutes, and there were bombardments here and there. It wasn't that intense. We expected a ceasefire to happen soon, you know, something like that. And then I took a car and then went back home. So I reached home about 11:30. I thought, okay, it's time to take a nap, you know, 11:30, 12. And then I put myself in bed. Still, the sounds of bombardment here and there, but things were fine. Children were around me, we are together. And 15 minutes later, someone called. Look, we got you the permit, you can leave now. Really? Yes, you can leave. We managed to take you away, to take you out with five other UNRWA people just to exit now. We spoke to everyone. Everything is fine. I said, really? I said, yes. Children were sitting in the room, looking, hearing, listening, and they got it. They got what happened. And then they started to laugh. They said, Dad, this is the third time you are trying to leave this week. It tells enough that we have something like this in Arabic, which says the third one should always work. So I told them, so I can leave? They said, okay, you can leave, but just take us with you. You just put us in our grand pass. You know, still things were not easy. It was still difficult. Okay, and that's how I crossed. So twice, to go to Gaza and then to Khan Yunis. And then I reached Jordan at about 8 p.m. in the evening, which means 12 hours later after the first, you know, attempt. And then what should I do with the APHA and with the other presentation that I had to do with San Bernardino University? So one was scheduled to be through Skype and Zoom, and the other one was to be somehow worked out. Everything went fine. 4 a.m. Amman time, I was awake, fresh, talking through Zoom with people in San Bernardino. At 8 p.m., I was at the airport flying to Doha, Qatar, then to New York, JFK, and then I arrived here at, what time was it?
2 o'clock.
About 2:30. And this time, when I left Gaza, I wasn't allowed to take my computer, not even a flash stick. Any gadget cannot exit Gaza today if you are a Palestinian, a Gazan, with the exception of one mobile phone. That's the only thing that you can carry outside of Gaza. A flash stick is not allowed, an external hard drive is not allowed. All of these things are impossible to exit. You can leave with only clothes. If you have perfume or cologne, this is also not allowed out. If you have makeup, this is also not allowed out. If you have shampoo, this is not allowed out. We bought something today, isn't it?
Yeah, no okay. Wheels on your suitcase.
So, and you need to pick a suitcase that is not of hard cover. It should be like clothes, you know. And it shouldn't be with wheels, not even with wheels. So the ones, the fancy ones that you pull and you go and you walk, you can't do that. You need something to carry, you know. If you are not carrying it, then don't bring it, you know. And it was interesting that I took one of those that you can't pull it, but it has four small wheels, you know. And the guard told me at the entrance of the Israeli checkpoint, they are going to send you back. You better get rid of those wheels. I said, okay, so I just destroyed those wheels and I went in, everything is fine. So not even a perfume is allowed, not even a toothpaste is allowed, not even a computer is allowed, nothing is allowed. So in comparison with 2015, things are a little bit different. I came with a laptop, but not with clothes. This time it's the other way around. So I came with clothes, but not with the laptop. And I asked her, and then should I wear a suit like last time, or should I come just, you know, informal? They said, no, Portland, they like things to be informal. I said, wow, nice. So I can't go to the evening sporty, you know, as you saw. Which is really nice, which is really wonderful. There are many stories that you could hear about Gaza, many strange stories. Whenever you sit with someone, you will hear something like Alice in Wonderland, you know, something like that. So I picked some few things to speak about, and hopefully, I hope I am successful. But there will be plenty of time for discussion. We will ensure that. Now, I would like to begin with speaking about movement restrictions, because what I was exposed to is a movement restriction, which means your movement is controlled. You are not allowed to leave when you need to leave. You are put under severe restrictions, and this is against the international humanitarian law. This is against the all, you know, convictions, whatever you can think of. This is not right, okay? But I would like to highlight some very important issue, which is patients, Palestinian patients, who are referred by Palestinian hospitals to receive therapy outside Gaza Strip. And those are mainly referred either to Palestinian hospitals in Jerusalem or Palestinian hospitals in West Bank or Israeli hospitals in Israel. In all cases, they need a permit or approval from ARIS to exit Gaza Strip to go to receive treatment. Usually, because this is a very expensive therapy, only severe cases are given such request to receive treatment abroad. abroad, I mean outside Gaza Strip. But look at the devastating figures. Only 52% of those get the permit to leave. And if you look deeply into that 52%, we have two percentages. One is related to the companions, and one is related to the patients himself. So if we say that about 58% of the patients can leave, then what about the other 42%? It's a question. You are denying the right of a sick person, severely sick person, to receive therapy for whatever reason. I don't know for whatever reason. And regarding the companion, each one is given the chance to choose or to pick one companion who would go with him or her to receive, I mean, while the therapy trip. Now, for those companions, usually the acceptance rate is 46%. So half of the patients who manage to go out severely sick will be going by themselves, will be going out by themselves. And this is, again, a very, interesting figure to think about. The figure 2,791, I can show it here. This chart shows how many people on average per month. You look at March, April, May, until September. The lowest is about 1,000 referrals. This is per month. And by the way, the previous statistics comes from the WHO September statistics. I mean, those percentages. So on average, between 1,000 and 3,000 people are referred to receive therapy outside Gaza Strip on a monthly basis. So if you speak about half of them not getting the permits, or 55% of them not getting the permit, we speak about an average 1,000, 1,500 people monthly who are not given the right to go and receive treatment. Now, this chart is very interesting. It shows the reason to the patient permit application. Green is approved, and then you see the yellowish and the reddish one. Red is denied. And the denial is usually because of security reason, and those security reasons are not always really understood. But let's assume that there is a security reason. But look at the yellowish ones, which is about 40%, between 25 and 45. These are just pending, or as they say, delayed. What does it mean, delayed? It means if a patient is a cancer patient, he needs to go out for radiotherapy because you don't have radiotherapy facility in Gaza. He will be given the permit, but his companion will not be given the permit because his application is still under processing. And then the question, would you go without your companion or would you miss the therapy session? And that's why in many cases you see a companion who is not really a very close, how to say, relative. Maybe not the mother, maybe not the son, maybe not the daughter. Maybe it's the grandmother, maybe it's the uncle. And usually now they look for someone who is older than 60, 65, or even 70, because with the older the age, the lesser the denial issue. So imagine you find someone who is not necessarily a brother or a sister or a father or a son, just in order to feel that someone is going out with you. Now, why is this? You never know why is that. Look at Physicians for Human Rights, which is an Israeli organization looking into the rights of patients. Sometimes they appeal against some of those denials, you know. And they find, look at their reports, that about 50% of them, the decision is changed from denial to acceptance. And the question is, how come that they were yesterday a threat and today they are okay? Which means that there is no really clear reason for rejecting things. Now, Israel claims that Gaza is not anymore under occupation, but if this is not occupation, what is occupation? If you are controlling the borders, if you are controlling the land, if you are controlling the air, if you are controlling the fishermen, you know, the seas, you know. Okay, sometimes they make 3 nautical miles, sometimes they make it 6 nautical miles, and sometimes they just shoot at the fishermen. So what kind of fishing is that? What kind of sea is that? So this is again, this is an active control, which is again occupation. Gaza is still until today under occupation. Now, people would say maybe in the West Bank it's better. It is better, but still, 82% only are approved, 13% are denied, and 5% are pending. So again, we speak about severely sick patients who are rejected treatment. And I would like to say another story just before going to the next thing. I had a cousin, and this we are talking about something before the 30th of March. He was 17 years old. And we speak now about, I think it was December or January. I think it was December 2017. So he get angry with his dad. He wanted some money. His father couldn't give him some money anyway. So he was angry and he went out and he said, okay, I'll go to the borders, you know. So he was out of frustration, out of anger. He was just moving towards the borders. And this is something that sometimes kids do. So what happened to him? He went to the borders and one Israeli gunman shot him on his knee. Now, the bullet didn't break any bone. It broke or it cut an artery, which is again a big issue. So they took him to the hospital, the Gaza European Hospital between Khan Yunis and Rafah. And they told him, your leg is not well. There is a problem with the arteries. He tried to get transferred to Israel in order to have some reconstruction therapy for those arteries. His permit was denied the first time. And why he was denied? Because there is a question. How did you get wounded? Did you fall from your house? Were you participating in something, you know, that is illegal? What was your problem? So we asked Physicians for Human Rights to intervene. We asked the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, the applying court. But again, this takes time. 3-4 days later, we applied again. It was rejected again. And 5 days later, they cut his leg from above the knee. His leg was cut for nothing. He is just a kid, 17 years old, who got angry with his father, you know, who decided to just, you know, show that I'm frustrated, I'm angry, I'm not happy. He got a bullet for that, and now he lost a leg for that. Who is going to help him? Who's going to support him? And again, a denial of his application. Because if you get wounded by an Israeli soldier, it means also that you are not entitled to receive therapy. So you live in a society that is overcrowded. We have more than now 2 million people living in this very small geographical area, about 365 square kilometers, which is, let me say, 24 miles in length and about 8 to 12 miles in width. Out of those 2 million people, we have 70% refugees, 1.4 million refugees, 1.35. Out of those, 50% children. Out of those, 53% unemployed. 65% of the young people unemployed. Million refugees received food aid packages from UNRWA. On top of all of that, you are completely controlled. On top of all of that, there is a big lack of hope. In 2015, when I was here, I was telling everyone, let's try to find hope for the young people. Let's work on finding hope. Today, I don't want to say that let's work on finding hope. No, there is no space for hope. Action should take place now, because enough speaking about hope. When you speak about hope, it means you speak about something that won't happen, unfortunately. No, today in Gaza, we need actions on the ground. We need ending the blockade. We need things to improve. We need all the destroyed houses to be reconstructed. Not all of them are reconstructed. We need an end to those every second week escalation. That children throughout the night scream because of the loud sounds of bombardment. This should all stop. One person asked me, what could the international community do to you in order to help? And I said something that you just said. Leave us alone. Leave us alone. We have resources. We have gas against our Gaza shores. We have everything that is needed. We have good brains. We have the most intellectual people in the whole Middle East, whether holders of masters or holders of PhD. Just give us the space. Just give us the freedom that we need. Just be just. That's the only thing that we need. We need to be left alone to grow like any other society that lives in dignity. Now, this story is going for decades and decades and decades. And then comes a question, who can help support people overcome the stresses, the psychological implications of living under occupation, of being a refugee with no hope of returning back home? And that's the story with which Gaza Community Mental Health Program started.
This was Dr. Yasser Abu Jamia of the Gaza Community Mental Health Program, speaking recently in Portland, Oregon. Their website with more information is gazamentalhealth.org. You've been listening to One Land, Many Voices. The full audio from this program will be available on the KBOO website later today. Go to kboo.fm/onelandmanyvoices. You can also subscribe to a podcast of this program by going to the KBOO website or the KBOO app.
Hi, I'm J.J. Johnson, host of the Gospel and More program, Sundays from 6 to 8 a.m. We are collecting yarn to make wool caps for the homeless community. Drop off yarn and caps at KBOO 20 Southeast 8th, Monday through Fridays, 9 to 5. We are also looking for knitters. For more information, contact KBOO Gospel and More at gmail.com or go to kboo.fm/gospel and more. The yarn and cap drive will end January the 31st.
KBOO Community Radio is proud.